So, you know, sometimes in AA, we get the overwhelming beauty of knowing people that are so profound and have wisdom and inspire us so greatly. So I now have known Jennifer for 7 seconds. But you come highly recommended. You come highly recommended. So
lower that bar.
No. Listen, think about our audience. I mean, the bar is pretty low already. You know, like, so the bar is pretty low. So Jennifer and I will spend more time together after this, but I would like to introduce, and we welcome so much, Plano, Texas, right?
Yep.
So nice long trip to come here and be with us, and we thank you and welcome you so much, Jennifer, and come on up and bring us. Thank you.
Run too. You don't want any of this splashing up on you. All right. Hey, y'all. My name is Jennifer Huddleston Kelly, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Jennifer.
I've been kept sober since December 5th of '92, and that's my miracle, believe it or not. And my watch is still on Dallas time. So I'm early. If I was in Dallas, I'm not. And so I get a text, and I'm naked, and I'm like, oh, my God. So that'll get the heart a-racing, I'm just saying. And it's not the first time that kind of craziness has happened for me. So I got too much stuff. Okay, so Scott was supposed to do the workshop, and when I saw him at Appalachian Regional Roundup, he said, hey, you want to do a workshop for me? And I said yes, and that's when I stopped listening. And and he told me what we were going to do. I have absolutely no idea what it was. And because he was going to be here and he'd run it and I'll just follow. I'm pretty good little duck right behind you. That's fine. I can wing it, and that's what I planned on doing. And then I got a call, and Scott's not coming. About a workshop. And of course I say, sure, no problem. That's the last time I thought about that. until I was on the plane, and then I'm like, oh, I probably ought to noodle on this a little bit. But then I decided to play a game instead. So last night after the meeting, I thought, I should probably think about this workshop a little bit. And I did, and then there was this show on. I really like Bob's Burgers. So this morning, let me tell you, I woke up focused. And about halfway through working on it, I decided we're doing a totally different topic than I had been noodling on for, you know, the 12 minutes that I had noodled before. And so today, let's just see what happens. I'm so excited to find out what's going to happen. I'm calling it. At first it was when we were wrong, and that just seemed negative, Nancy. So we're going to call it a series of surrenders. And it is my hope that this workshop will be useful to both the person who's brand new, because I certainly set that bar high, didn't I? I mean, like, if you show up, you get points. But also some people with some time. Because a part of my story is that I was a high-bottom drunk, and it's taken me a real long time to start not trusting my brain. I mean, to start. I went to jail right before I was 10 years sober. Sober! With Fonzie in the car. On the way to speak for 250 people. So we'll get to that when we get to step 10. So I've made some big mistakes publicly in sobriety. I mean, I don't do it quiet. It's not on the down low. I'm that person. I'm Wile E. Coyote style, man. I'm gonna hit that wall hard, and there will be a me-sized cutout when I fall. And so, but I'll tell you what kind of led to me noodling on this. There were a couple of things. The first was I went to a meeting I didn't want to go to. I'm sure you want to go to every meeting you go to. There was one this week I did not want to go. I didn't want to go. I don't want to go. And it was on Zoom. Like, I didn't even have to put on pants. And I didn't want to go. I don't want to go. I do not want to go. Why do I have to go? And it has to do with a personality that I'm just not crazy about. She makes me feel dumb. And so I go to this meeting, and of course the person says the thing that I needed to hear. Of course it had to be her. And what she said was, and I'm paraphrasing, what she said was, my alcoholism returns through the doorway created by guilt and shame. I'm going to add secrets. Secrets, guilt, and shame. That's what creates the doorway for alcoholism to return through. And I have been noodling on that since the minute she said it. Because I think about the times I was thirstiest in sobriety. And secrets, guilt, and shame are it. That's what was going on. I wasn't living out loud. My sponsor wasn't fully briefed. Or I wasn't fully willing to do what was suggested to me. And so those secrets, guilt, and shame allowed a porthole for alcoholism to return. And I think it's really important to remember that relapse is the last step. I mean, like, picking up is the last step. The drink, the drug, the whatever is the last step in relapse. There's a whole bunch of stuff that happens before then. And luckily, gracefully, we have the opportunity to revise our actions, our thinking, our behavior, whatever, before we get something at the end of our arm. And that's my story, is that for 29 years, I think I've surrendered and then I haven't. And then, you know, and or I revert back to old behavior, which is no longer old anymore. And then I get thirsty again. And so I want to talk just a little bit. I say a little bit, and it's going to be a while. I, too, am my favorite speaker. I had a friend say that nobody enjoys the melodious tones of Jennifer's voice more than Jennifer. And it is true. I have never met a microphone I didn't like. And okay, so... consent is important. You don't touch another man's mic. Okay. It's all good.
Sorry.
So let's talk a little bit about the first step, surrender. And for me, that's just surrendering behavior. I've got alcoholism. It's killing me. Don't drink no matter what. I don't know about you, but that was kind of my mantra for a while. Don't drink no matter what. Don't drink no matter what. Don't. We get to the second step, and I got a new mantra. There's a God, and it's not me. There's a God, and it's not me. But on my first step, it's simply I will do whatever it takes not to pick up that first drink. And here's the thing. I've had alcoholism, so I think this is going to be simple and easy. I always think things are going to be simple and easy. Just don't drink. I mean, just don't drink. Just don't drink. How hard could this be? It's a liquid. You know, I would sit in meetings and people would talk for an hour about powerlessness, and I would think, it's a liquid. It's a liquid. How can it have all this dominion and power over me? And it seemed like the minute I walked out of that place, my brain's going, now is a vodka watermelon drinking? I mean, Jell-O shots seem like they're kind of in the gray area between drinking and food. You know, I'm sitting in the meeting and I'm like, yup, got it, check. And the second I leave your presence, my brain starts eating my face off looking for loopholes. That's just how alcoholism works in my life. And so the first thing that I need to know is this is a practical program. It is practical. And I had to look things up because my old sponsor was an English teacher. And so the word practical means given to practice. Doesn't mean I'm going to get it right every time. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make a lot of mistakes because mistakes are what I've practiced thus far. And when I got sober, I was obsessed with where did I make the wrong turn. I thought if I could figure out where I made the wrong turn, we could somehow, I don't know why that was important to me. Because I don't know if y'all hear what we hear, but it don't matter how the donkey got in the ditch, get him out, you know. But like most newcomers, I am obsessed with when did I make the wrong turn? When did I make the wrong turn? Because I started out a little Jesus girl. You know, I was going to be a minister. Oh, there were some ministrations, but it was not religious. I'm trying to figure out where I made the wrong turn, and I came to the conclusion that it was the Pink Floyd concert in 1987. And the one with the big inflatable pig? Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah. I remember part of it. And I came to the conclusion that if I had never gone to the Pink Floyd concert in 1987, I would not be an alcoholic today. And I was happy to report to my sponsor. I got it figured out. And I tell her, and she said, "Girl, that was not the one wrong turn. You've never made a right turn. I mean, you just never made a right turn, honey." And let's couple that with the fact that you're never going to be able to drink alcohol successfully. That's all you need to know. That's really all I need to know. But I'm going to have to practice to get better. Dishonesty, I've been practicing longer than drinking, I promise you. As soon as I could talk, I was lying. As soon as I had pockets, I was stealing. I mean, why would they put the gum down that low if they didn't want little people just shoving it in their Oshkoshes, you know? And I sponsor all kinds of girls who go, "I stole once, got caught, and I was done." I'm like, quitter? I mean, come on. That's just data on how to do it better. Why? Anyway, so I'm going to have to practice. The second thing is, this is an honest program. Oh, man, you lose me there. So I'm going to have to tell you my first experience with honesty when I knew I wouldn't get caught. I mean, okay, it's okay to come clean if you know you're busted. That's where we start. But one of my first ahas going to meetings was this recognition that came over me during probably maybe my third meeting, which is, "Jennifer, nobody's going to be able to help you if they don't know what's really going on. You cannot be fine. You can't be fine in AA. You just can't. No one will know how to help you if you don't tell the truth about what's going on." And so I knew that. I mean, and I started really trying to tell the truth about. Sometimes it was, "I'm not okay and I don't know why. And I don't know what that means and I don't have the words for it yet, but I'm not okay." And sometimes that's just enough. Y'all know. I guess I was around 6 months sober. I wasn't quite 6 months sober. And my grandfather died. And I didn't like him. So, he didn't like me. Just to be fair, we were on the same page with that deal. But I knew I was supposed to go to my first little conference that weekend. But I knew I wasn't supposed to go. I mean, I was supposed to do stuff with the family, I guess. And so I came in, and I was living with my mom and dad at the time, and I said, "Well, I guess I'm not going to that conference." And my parents were not tickled that I was in AA yet. They got there. But it was really weird because my dad said, "I don't know about that. I think you probably ought to go to that thing this weekend and be with your people. And then maybe you can come back and do what needs to be done." And that really was huge because he wasn't a big fan. He really believed if I just come back to church, I'd be fine. God bless that church if I had. And so I went, and I had a spiritual awakening that weekend, and the awakening was that I stood up at the top of a canyon, and I said, God, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you are, but I believe that you are, and I need you now. And I was able to come back and do what a good daughter and a good granddaughter does, and that was kind of my first experience with that, frankly. But I was on probation, felony probation. So I'm a little go-getter, and I had tried to call the office to tell them that I was going, that I was leaving the county, and I couldn't get anybody on the phone, and I left anyway. And so I came back to my appointment, and I'm sitting in the parking lot, and I'm like, dude, I gotta tell them I did this, or I'm gonna get drunk. And I do, and I mean, I got newcomer thinking, so you know what I think. I'm going to prison. I'm going to prison. I went to my grandfather's funeral. I'm going to prison. And I mean, y'all's voices are playing in my head. Got to be willing to go to any length. Willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol. So I walk into this probation office, and I'm like, I'm going to prison. Today is the day. And I walk in there, and he says, have you violated your probation in any way? And I said, yes, sir, I have. And he said, what? And I told him. I left the county. I went to my grandfather's funeral. And I tried to call, but I couldn't get through, and I went. And whatever the consequences are, I'm willing to accept whatever I need to do. And he said, Jennifer, I would never know you left. I said, I know. Don't make me feel dumb about this. It's already feeling super weird, dude. I have never willingly told on myself in my life, and I'll go down with the ship. And he said, but you told me anyway. And I said, I'm not willing to risk my sobriety. I've got to tell the truth. And he said, do you know what this means? And I thought, I'm going to prison. And he said, I have no reason not to trust you because you told the truth even when I wouldn't find out. Y'all, I was on fire. I got me some pamphlets and a tambourine. I was on fire. I was so excited about this revelation that I shared it in every freaking meeting, which was fine. There were some folks there who didn't know what I was sharing. But then I went to breakfast with my mom and dad. I told them how honesty works. My mother's face scrunched up in a way I could not fully duplicate. She was like, do you just lie for sport? And I was like, well, pretty much. I mean, I tell the truth, but I can't think of anything else. But like, she didn't know. But that was this doorway to honesty leads to freedom. It leads to freedom. And I mean, it leads to freedom even if they lock you up. Because it's honest consequences for my actions. Period. End of story. So it's a practical program, it's an honest program, and it's a we program. And that's the part that's hardest for me, is letting other people in. It's letting other people help. It's listening to your experience, strength, and hope. It's admitting I don't know. It's admitting it's too big. And so there are a lot of things that I should have walked through with other people that I didn't. That I didn't. I had a miscarriage, I don't know, 12 years ago. I told one AA friend she didn't drop everything and run. She didn't know what to do. It was too big and too scary for her. And because she didn't react, I really didn't tell much of anybody else. I told my sponsor. But beyond that, I mourned and I grieved and I did it alone. In the last year, I've lost my mom, and I'm going to talk a bunch about that tonight. Oh, yay. And that'd be a fun talk. And I started menopause, so we just get bring the clean out. It's just been a super fun year. I'm missing 2020. But it was really the first time that I remember consciously walking through something with everybody knew. Everybody was updated. I was accountable to the ladies I sponsored, to my sponsor, to the woman at the grocery store. I talked to everybody. And man, why would we try to carry some of this stuff alone? Why? I mean, what is it in me that thinks there's some virtue or value to doing things all by myself? I can't. We can. And that's my experience. So with each of the steps, I'm going to kind of give a prompt. And by the way, I'm going to combine a couple of steps, so we'll only be here till lunch. So the question for step one is, and I really like journaling. I am a big fan of that. It's often the only way I can get down to what's really going on with me, and I have some tips and tricks on that. What I'm going to tell you is there's two ways that I know to do it. Set a timer and keep the pen moving. Do not worry about penmanship. Do not worry about spelling. Forget margins. Just keep the pen moving for a period of time. You got to outrun the critic in your head. You've got to outrun the BSer in your head. You got to outrun your ego. You've got to keep the pen moving. Today, I generally do it, rather than with a timer, I do it with a number of pages. I write 3 pages in that way. If God hasn't shown up by the 3rd page, I write 5. And that's just, and keep the pen moving. And if you run out of things to say, then you write. I don't know why the hell I'm even doing this. There's nothing, this is the dumbest thing I've ever, until something breaks loose. But I have never done writing this way where something didn't break loose. And so the question that I have for step one is, do I practice AA like my life still depends on it? Ouch. Second step, what we're going to, in the second step, what we're going to surrender is we're going to surrender authority. Sort of. and in the big book, there's a story about Fitz Mayo. And he has an awakening. He was a minister's son. He was sick of religion. And then he comes into AA, and just like the rest of us, he got hornswoggled. Because then they start they get you convinced you're one of us. You're one of us. This is fatal, and obsession, and the allergy, and the body's obsession. And it's not an allergy of the obsession, though it kind of is, if you think about it. I'm not allergic to obsession. It's my love language. Anyway. So, then they slide in. Your only defense is a power greater than yourself, and he's not thrilled about that. And he has this thought, which is, is it possible that every religious person I've ever met is wrong? All of them. I mean, there's a bunch of them that are wrong. But all of them? On everything? And for us, sometimes the question is it possible that every AA that I've sat with is wrong? Is it possible that every Al-Anon that I've heard is wrong? Am I willing to be the authority in my life? I can't manage my Netflix. That's the one thing my poor big daddy has full dominion over, the remote controls. That's it. Run a tight ship. Though I'm sure he's letting the dog sleep in the bed right now. But anyway, there are so many things I am quick to tell you I am not good at or capable of, and yet I think I need to be the ultimate authority in my life. And so I've got to surrender this authority to a concept, just a concept, an idea of something greater than myself. And that always feels so weird. Okay, I'm going to have to tell you about the potato baby Jesus. And by the way, I neither endorse nor oppose Jesus. He's just a part of my story. But I had this, I still have her. I have a niece, and I actually have several. But the little one was going to church, and it's hard to come up with arts and crafts projects for toddlers. I know this from experience. And so at her church, at Christmas time, they made the potato baby Jesus. And the potato baby Jesus was literally a potato with wiggle eyes that they wrapped in a dryer sheet. So it started smelling good. Things went wrong with the potato baby Jesus later. But anyway, and my baby niece sprouted. Jesus sprouted and turned into like Groot. But anyway, Lexi loved, I mean, loved the potato baby Jesus. She carried it everywhere. It was in her little purse if they went to the grocery store. And her older sisters thought this was the funniest thing they had ever seen in their lives. And they loved to just torture her playing hot potato baby Jesus. And I tell that story first because it's adorable. But second, because that's a little bit how the second step felt to me. When they're saying choose your own conception of God, I'm like, okay, we're going to take a dryer sheet, some wiggle eyes, and a potato. And spoiler alert, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to it. I'm telling you, if your life is in the condition mine is, it still seems like a better idea. But it feels weird. It feels like there's a part of me that absolutely knows this is necessary, and there's this other part that's like, but I just made this up. I just made, how can this be? And so what I wound up doing was I was going to counseling. I make it sound like I made some decisions. The state of Texas made me go to counseling. I chose counselor because he was cheap. That's it. I mean, when it was my idea, it was a good idea. But then when the state of Texas said I had to do it, I needed a bargain. And a friend of mine said pastoral counseling is the way to go. They work on a sliding scale. You can get a counseling session for less than $20 if you're broke, and you are. And so I went to pastoral counseling. And, y'all, I got a counselor who was a retired minister from my childhood faith. Purely coincidental. And he was on oxygen. He was about 109 years old. And I'm a brand new oversharing alcoholic. It was fantastic. God did some awesome. Anyway. And just the cherry on top of the fun sundae is he loved the 12 steps. He was not one of us. He was not one of us. But he loved the 12 steps and felt like it was a spiritual path for any human being, and said if he had learned about them before he joined the ministry, he would never have joined the ministry. He just would have taught people how to take the 12 steps. Another interesting coincidence. So I get to this second step, and suddenly you guys say, choose your own conception, and I become theological. And I'm like, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And I try to read the Bible from beginning to end. Y'all ever started at the first? Ooh, it's dry. I mean, there's a lot of spots that are... I never even made it to the ark. I mean, I'm new, sober, and twitching, and... brain's eating my face off, and all that's going on is begetting, and, you know, oh, my God, it's so boring. So that didn't work, so I set a higher goal, you know, and I decided that I would take a world religions class to take the second step. I mean, it seems reasonable. I knew I really didn't have that much time, but I did have the textbook, and so I just kind of skimmed. I thought I could take some of the, you know, the powers that have lasted, not the weird ones. And I would scrunch them all together and make a God. And I lost interest in that project as well. So the night before I'm supposed to meet with my sponsor, I'm trying to write things out in calligraphy. I wish I was making this up, but y'all know newcomers. I want this thing to be suitable for framing. And the next morning, my step work is gone, y'all. I have never found the calligraphy God ever again. You know what this means when a sponsee says, my four-step was almost done, and I've lost the notebook. I can no longer go, bull, because that piece of paper somehow disappeared, and I had to write a God in 5 minutes that was going to keep me sober 30 years. And I scribbled some stuff out, and I met with my sponsor, and she said, this is wonderful. And then I went out, and I started seeking that God. And what I seek, I find. I was looking for a teacher, a parent, and a friend, and I started looking for God showing up as a teacher, a parent, and a friend. And my first spiritual experience with that was I was holding this baby named Grace, another coincidence. I was teaching preschool, and they don't usually let me have babies because babies don't do nothing, and they're so boring. And what they do is not that great. And they yak all over you, and they cry, and they poop. I want them to bite and say, mine, and do some stuff. But Grace wouldn't stop crying, and we were shorthanded, and so Grace and I, we're walking and talking and walking and talking and walking. Bounce, bounce, bounce. Come on, Grace, for the love of God, stop crying. And at some point while I'm bouncing and talking to Grace, I look down, and the blankets come off of her toes. And I don't know if you've seen baby toes recently, but they are the most amazing things I've ever seen. And I see her toes, and they take my breath away. They get grosser later on. But in the beginning, they are so teeny tiny, perfect, and pink that I got tears in my eyes. And I start thinking about, you know, we could have hooves or fins or, I don't know, flaps. But the God of my understanding, came up with baby toes. I don't understand a whole bunch of this other stuff, but I know that that God I wrote on the paper came up with this. And I start seeking, and I start finding. So who am I to say that God won't help? Who am I to say that God can't help? Who am I to say that God isn't creating out of the messy stuff in my life? Why do I think that God has left when things change? When the reality is that the only evidence that I have that God exists is change. The change in the seasons. The change in alcoholics. The change in a human heart. So the question for step two is, God, here's why I don't trust you. And the reason I wrote this one as the question for step two is I tried to trick a sponsee into doing the steps without knowing she was doing the steps. I'm not above it. I'm saving your life, dum-dum. And so in order to try and manipulate her, which went swimmingly, by the way, I said, let's do some journaling together. I'll do it. You do it. We'll do it together. And the first assignment I gave her is, God, here's why I don't trust you. Just to appease her, I said I would do the writing. And so I'm doing the writing, and the first page and a half is me telling God, well, of course I trust you. And I write out my resume in case God didn't remember. And then God kicked in. And the next four pages was about how I've been trying to single-handedly keep my mama alive and well. And that's not my department. And I've been managing my finances, thank you very much. So I'm broke again. And I've still got a couple of little secrets that really aren't anybody's business, but they're killing me. And here's why I don't trust you. I've been running my own life, and it's not going well. And I've been blaming you. Step three. I surrender control. What? That's so dumb. I used to have a sponsor that said if we could really do step three all the way, we would be content to never have our own way ever again. What an order. And I'm sure we would willingly eat broccoli at every meal too, but come on now. But I really do get what we're asking here. The question is, am I trusting God or playing God? These are my two choices. We've got two states. Am I trusting God or playing God? Am I in recovery or am I in relapse? These are our two states. Two and only two. Until I've got it down to two choices, I'm going to wander around and bang into stuff. When I've got it down to two choices, then I can make a decision. So am I trusting God or playing God? And this shows up all over the place for me, but I'm just going to tell one little story. I start sponsoring these little minions. I could not wait to sponsor. And the reason I could not wait to sponsor, and y'all probably have some of these around here, is there are some sponsors who have little rows of perfect little ducks, and they walk right behind them. And they stand at the podium on birthday night, and they say, I would not be alive if it was not for my sponsor. And they, I mean, the meeting runs long. Because they have to talk about all the wonderful things that their sponsor has done to change their life. And I can't wait. I've been waiting for this since kindergarten. I just want some little minions to watch. Jennifer Kelly has changed my life. And instead, I don't know about you, I didn't get none of those sponsees. None of them. I get the little feral cat.
Come on.
They stand up on the podium with their one-year chip and they say, well, my sponsor's a little better than me. Because she's been around longer. So I'm sponsoring, and there was a period of time where I went to talk at this group where most of the membership was not of legal drinking age. And I used to call it talking to the children. And I went every Wednesday night for a month, and I'm talking to the children tonight, and I would go out there, and they loved them some me. And then I start sponsoring 42 of them because I'm getting her as a sponsor. Why don't you get her as a sponsor? We'll all get her as a sponsor. And so there, what I learned was at that group, there's the sponsor of the month club, and they all go, you know, it's like, Jennifer is my sponsor until we all get annoyed with Jennifer. Then we all go to Nancy. And so I'm sponsoring the children. And let me just tell you something. They did everything I did in the bar in the A&A club. I mean, it was girls gone wild up in there. Little tramp stamps just flying around. And people would come to tattle on them, and I'd say, which one was it? And they'd say, well, the one whose honey's always hanging out of her shorts. I said, that's all of them. I'm going to have to be more specific. I got a type right now. Anyway, so I'm sponsoring all these little girls, and some of them are doing great, and some of them aren't, and a lot of them didn't stay very long, and I came to believe that their parents hit a bottom. They didn't. But it was my responsibility to give them a good representation of Alcoholics Anonymous and to take them through the steps to the best of our combined abilities. And some of them went out and drank and seemed to be doing fine. I mean, they really do. Some of them may have gotten caught smoking a joint and their mom and dad threw them in treatment because they didn't know what to do. And that's okay. They got exposed to what they needed to get exposed to. They hung out with a fellowship and managed to get through high school, and now they're doing PTA or playing bunco or whatever, and they're fine. Or they seem to be. It's really none of my business, but I do follow them every now and then just to see. I have one that has stayed continuously sober, and she came in when she was 17. She's going to see 50 years if she keeps it up. And she's a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is hilarious to me. I love getting around her sponsees and going, let me tell you a story or two. Because they just think, oh, her sponsees are the little baby duck. She's amazing. And I'm like, oh, come on now. She used to move guys in and not know she'd done it. I'm like, how long has he been there? Does he pay rent? No. I just bought him a toothbrush and he stayed. Anyway, so during this time I'm sponsoring this little gal, and she has a little boyfriend she met in the rooms, and they, you know, they're just kicking it. And she calls me up and she says, yeah, there are consequences to kicking it without protection. And I say, I know.
And she said, yeah, that's happening. And I say, oh no. because daddy has gone back out, and he's in the hospital having OD'd on heroin. And she's, you know, I mean, she is 12 seconds away from that. And yet she's talking about, you know, this baby, and it's just going to be, it's a magical gift from God. And I'm like, oh my God, I would not trust this little girl with a kitten. And I'm running around, and I'm, you know, I'm trying to be a responsible sponsor and just take her through the steps, and let's do some running, and let's do some praying on it. But I'm calling my sponsor going, this is bad. And she thinks that he's just going to stop doing heroin. Oh, well, I'm a father now. Guess I'll buy some golf shirts. You know, I mean, none of this is making any kind of sense. And she is just singing Disney songs in between wanting to drink, you know, And I mean, my guts are hanging out because I'm scared to death for her. I'm scared to death for that baby. I'm scared to death for all of them. And when I get in fear, I don't have a filter. And I don't really necessarily pay attention to who I'm talking to. And so I got another sponsee on the horn, and we're talking about something, and I'm just like, what do you think about what's going on with what's her name? Because I'm just saying. And I start, you know, talking about all my concerns about what's going to happen. And this little sponsee, who, it's the one who now has, I don't know, 20 years. And she said, hasn't she done the third step prayer? Maybe this is God's will. Well, I never thought of that. And what I'll tell you is that little what's-her-name has not continuously stayed sober. She has been in and out for this whole entire couple of decades. But I do believe that that baby girl kept her alive. I do believe that. And if it had been up to me, a different decision would have been made. So, am I trusting God or am I playing God? So the question for step three is, have I turned my will and my life over to God or a better version of myself? Ouch! Because a lot of times it's just a better version of myself. Step four and five, surrender my version of the story. I don't like this at all. I mean, I like writing about what they did. I like my version. I got some good versions of the story. Oh. So what we're going to do is we're going to unload our secrets and find out what we don't know. And I think that's the best way to explain what an inventory is. It is not the horometer. We are not trying to... There you go. She caught it. It's not about breaking us into groups of, oh, the super sick and the kind of sick and the not that sick at all. It's really about finding out what I don't know. And there's a bunch of it. But if I don't know what I don't know and she don't know what I don't know, how are we going to know something new? And that, I really and truly, I believe at its heart, that's what the inventory is. It's just a way to kind of go through and systematically figure out what we don't know so that God can show us something new. And so I got the goofiest story on the inventory process. When I step back from my emotions, what I discover is, just like Bill talks about, is this dumb commercial inventory, which is a little dry. It's not how I feel about it. It really is, let's just do this. Let's just look at what we got in stock up in here. And so the story that I tell the gals that I sponsor about what an inventory is, it's like when I was a little girl, I was a little bit quirky, and I liked them little tiny boxes of cereal, and I wanted to keep my cereal boxes. They're just so cute, these little bitty boxes. And so, and my parents were like, oh, no big deal. And so we had a little place where I could, I'm making this up, by the way. I didn't keep cereal boxes. I was a crafter. I had a bunch of crap in my room. But anyway, so I got these little bitty cereal boxes, and my parents were like, that's fine. We'll just put your cereal boxes on this little shelf over here.
bigger I get, the bigger the cereal boxes get, and the more there are. And there's a lot of them. And then I get grown, and oh, good gravy, I got to move these things every time I move. And I run out of bookshelf space, and then they're in every closet, and I'm not using the oven. All I'm doing is eating cereal. So we're shoving cereal boxes in the oven, and then, you know, they're under the bed. They're on the dining room table. Cereal boxes have kind of taken over my life. And when you got a little cereal box hoarding problem, it's gonna control who can be in your life and how you're gonna live your life. Because it's not like you're gonna say, "Hey, girls, come over, let's have fun girl wine night. Just pull up a cereal box and have a seat." Because they're gonna see this and go, "Ooh, she's a special one now, isn't she?" You know. And you meet a fella at the bar, you're not going to say, "Hey, come on over and we'll knock the cereal boxes off the bed." Or the counter, whatever works for you. Because anybody who's willing to be in cereal box heaven may not be somebody I'm willing to have into my cereal box heaven. And then I get sober. And that's all I get. I get sober. And I'm talking to this sponsor, and I'm like, we can talk about anything, but I'm not going to say nothing about them cereal boxes. I mean, she already thinks I'm a weirdo, and she's a nice lady with hygiene and car insurance, and I don't want her knowing about me, But one day, I'm talking to her on the phone, and she asked me how work was, and I say, "Oh, I didn't go to work today," and she goes, "Why?" And I go, "Well, there was a cereal box incident." And I realize I said it, and she said, "Did you say cereal boxes?" And I said, "Yeah, uh-huh." And she said, "Do you collect cereal boxes?" I do. "I used to collect cereal boxes." "Really?" And she said, I'm gonna bet I could guess a couple of things about your cereal box collection. How many you got?" And I'm like, "A couple." "So?" And she said, "I'm gonna guess that you really only have three different kinds of cereal." And I'm like, "How did she know that? I really only have three kinds of cereal." She said, I'm gonna bet I can guess what kind of cereal you got." "No, you can't." And she said, "You got Rosamma Krispies? You got Frady Flakes? And you got Getting Lucky Charms." And it's just crazy because she nailed it. And she said, "Yeah, I used to have a pretty extensive cereal box collection myself. I don't know if you know this, but those boxes don't have any value. Like none. I checked. It doesn't matter how old they are. It doesn't matter how many you have. Those cereal boxes in and of themselves have absolutely no value. As a matter of fact, they're probably causing you more problems than they're worth." But, she said, "You know, once you get the prizes out of the boxes..." What prizes?" "No, there's prizes in every box. There's a prize in every box." "What do you mean there's a prize in every box?" "No, seriously, there's a prize in every box. I did this with my sponsor. We went through it. First, we sorted them into piles. And then we went through and we pulled all the prizes out of the boxes. And then we got to get rid of the boxes. And let me tell you, the prizes don't take up nearly as much space as the boxes do." And that's what an inventory is. It's pulling the prizes out of every box. And the prizes are life lessons. It's how to be a better daughter, how to be a better sister, how to be a better friend, how to be a better person, how to be a better AA, how to be more effective, more understanding, more giving. Okay, let's go look at the boxes. And so we're going to sort them out. And in that process, what we're going to discover is I have these stories that I've told myself all my life that may or may not be partially true, but rarely are they completely true. I have never considered any other point of view. I have never considered any other experience. I have never looked at things from any other angle except mine. And so, as I am doing this,
going through this inventory process. I don't know what time it is because I'm in Dallas, so we're just going to talk until I'm done. So anyway, I'm going through this process, and when I get to the inventory on my mama, my parents were the hardest inventory things to write about. And for years, I wouldn't write about my mom because she did the best she could, and, you know, and it just, I don't know, for some reason, that was one that I just felt like I had no right to resent her in any way, shape, or form. Now, I did. It was coming out my pores, but for some reason, I just felt like it was a betrayal to write that on the inventory. I'd write about my dad, but for some reason, I just didn't want to take a look at my mom. And then I got to a spot in my life where I could no longer deny the influence that she had had in my life, because I was trying to play by her rules and it wasn't going well for me. It wasn't going well for her either, but it really wasn't going well for me, and she doesn't drink herself to death. I do. And so I start doing this inventory on my mom, and y'all, I wrote some ridiculous things. My mother was a school teacher, and she, her job was her identity. It was very, very important to her, and she was a very good teacher. And but because of that, you know, she was busy, and she was busy when other moms were staying home and making cupcakes. And so I, at every party, I had to bring the napkins, the cups, the Diet Coke, whatever it was. Do not say I will bake anything, Jennifer. I am not baking anything. And so that winds up on my inventory, which I'm now kind of embarrassed. Like, you know, why didn't we call CPS? My mama didn't bake cupcakes for the party. And but there was a lot of other stuff too, and when I went over this with the stuff with my sponsor, you know, some things came out about how my mother never told me I was pretty, and we didn't paint toenails or braid hair. My dad was actually the better toenail painter, and which is funny because he was a football coach. But anyway, so we go through all of this stuff, and my sponsor says, "Tell me about the lady who raise your mom." I said, "Oh, she's a broom rider. Woo! She was a broom rider. Nanny knew the commandments God left out, you know." And I start writing about her, and then she asked about the woman who raised my grandmother, and I didn't know a whole lot about my grandmother's life, though I learned more later. And my grandmother grew up in that generation when there was a time when if there was a bunch of kids and you couldn't feed them, you kind of farmed them out somewhere. And my grandmother was the oldest, the smartest, and the strongest. And so she got sent to live with an aunt and uncle for a period of time. And I started imagining how that would feel if I was, I don't know, 10, 12 years old. Would I think it's because I'm the smartest and the strongest? Or would I think I'm the disposable one? And when I step back and I look at my grandmother's life, I could see that she lived her whole life in step one, in this fear of powerlessness, because that is what she had been faced with over and over and over again, and it's much too long a story to explain. But her response to that was that I will have complete dominion and power over the things that I can have complete dominion and power over, including my mother. And as we are talking about this inventory process, my sponsor says, "Where would your mother learn to paint toenails and braid hair and have slumber party talks?" And y'all, that resentment disappeared in a heartbeat. I'd been so angry that my mother never gave me Snickers. I'd been trick-or-treating for Snickers my whole life. She didn't have any Snickers. But the cool thing was that the minute I recognized she didn't have Snickers, I could see all the other stuff that she gave me. Like, all, I mean, she had Reese's, she had M&M's, she had all kinds of super duper amazing things that she gave me, but I could never see it when all I wanted was the things she didn't have. So I got to give up my version of the story. And I got to start seeing other people from a different vantage point. The steps are going to revolutionize our life. There are two definitions for revolution. One is a revolving door, and that is to look at something from a different angle. The other is the overthrowing of a government. This is my government. And I don't care how you vote, the government lies.
And so I've got to expose those lies, and that's what 4 and 5 do for me. So the question for steps 4 and 5 is, what am I hanging on to that no longer fits in my sober life? I don't know about y'all, but I got a closet full of stuff that's optimistic. They no longer fit. They no longer fit. Or they were a style that I enjoyed a long time ago. I still have some Doc Martens. Those things, no. What wear am I going to wear? I mean, come get your grandma. What is she doing in the Doc Martens? And they hurt. They rub the back of my fat. They're not fun to wear. I mean, that'd be like me hanging on to my size 12 Rocky Mountain jeans. What in the heck am I going to do with those? I'll tell you what I'm going to do with those. I'm going to make dog toys out of them. I couldn't put those on my thigh now. But I have other things that I'm hanging on to that no longer fit my lifestyle. Am I cussing? Am I using aggressive language in Alcoholics Anonymous? Is that an image that I really want or need? I do that. You know? I don't want to go into it. I don't want to get all up in your hula hoop. This is yours to figure out. But there's a lot of stuff that I do that's about maintaining some kind of image. And in the last couple of years, I've learned a lot about how important my reputation is. And I want to live authentically. I want to live transparently. And sometimes that's humbling. Steps 6 and 7, I'm going to surrender my weapons. And that's what my character defects are. They're weapons. And they give me the illusion that they keep me safe. What they really do is they separate me from you. And by separating me from you, they separate me from God. It's that simple. So the first thing I got to do is learn how to surrender my weapons. How do I lay down my weapons? And a lot of times for me, that starts with a pause. Am I just willing right now not to use it? But then the second thing is, after I've surrendered the weapons, there's going to be this awkward period of time. The first thing that I consciously tried to surrender was my gossiping. Oh, I love it. It's these little party favors that I just hand out to keep people coming back. And because I have news, and people bring it to me. News you can use. And then I saw the damage that it can do. I saw it in my inventory. My sponsor pointed out, why would anybody do a fifth step with you? And I said, to my knowledge, I've never shared fifth step information. And she said, yeah, but why would they believe you wouldn't? You share everything else. So I try to surrender that bad boy, and I don't know how. I mean, I don't know how. I sit down at dinner, my butt hasn't even hit the chair, and the AAs are going, did you hear about such and such and such and such? And don't even pretend men don't do it. They have been some of my best sources. They just know to tell me, and then I tell everybody else. They're efficient. I know, it's hurtful. But anyway, and what I discover is there's going to be this uncomfortable period of time where I know I'm not supposed to do it, but I don't know what else to do. And so I'm just sitting there trying to be still and quiet while other people are talking some wild smack. And the first night that I tried not to gossip, it was hilarious. We were at a Mexican food restaurant, and I ate. That's all I did. I just ate. I knew I wouldn't talk if there was food, so I ate everything. I ate yours. I ate mine. I ate the chips. I did salsa shots. I ate everything on the table. I got out of there. I looked like the rat in Charlotte's Web after the fair. Oh, so cool. I'm waddling out of that restaurant, but I have not gossiped not one single lick. And y'all, the whole drive home, I almost broke my arm congratulating myself on how I fully recovered from my gossiping problem. And then I took the inventory of every one of those losers that was at dinner. And that's what happens when I remove my character defects. When I remove my character defects, I set one down, pick three more up. I mean, it's just the shell game. I'm gonna be messing with something. It's when I give it to God that it looks different. When I give it to God, I'm going to be uncomfortable for a little bit, which means I'm going to need to be talking to God. It also means I'm going to need to be studying your paper, because not all of you gossip like I do. And so some of you have figured out a way to do this. And And some of my Al-Anon friends were big helpers in this whole deal for me. Because we would have this meeting. We started the meeting. There was a small break where we would have cookies and drink coffee and then go back for the main meeting. And in that in-between time, that's gossip session. And so we would go outside to the courtyard and we'd be walking and talking. And this one Al-Anon friend of mine, she was so good. Because alcoholics are like us. They look like a dog on a sock. If you keep wiggling it, we're going to, you know. And so we were talking about stuff, ne'er-do-well, out in the courtyard. And the Al-Anon friend of mine said, oh, man, you think that's something? Let me tell you what I did in my first year around here. And she started telling a story, and we went back in for the meeting. We were 20 minutes into that meeting before I went, where did the sock go? The homegirl just shoved that sock in her purse and walked right off with it. And I thought, that's pretty slick. We didn't even notice the sock left. She offered up something about herself, and we weren't even interested in homegirl anymore. We were laughing at her stories. I wonder if I could do that. Fun fact. No matter what dumb thing you tell me, I can usually beat it. And so and so I start trying that. AA is the only place I've ever been where they encourage you to copy off of other people's papers, you know? And so I start watching how you respond to things I don't know how to do, and I surrender that weapon, and God gives me a tool. I surrender my weapon, and God gives me a tool. And if we do this effectively, we wind up with a really efficient toolkit. Some of us get in here, and I'm not going to lie, because you know it to be true. They get a hammer and a screwdriver, and they go, good enough. And that's okay for them. But if you're going to build a big, fat, beautiful life, you're going to need more than a hammer and a screwdriver. You're just going to. And I'm not content to build a birdhouse. I'm not content for me and God to build a birdhouse. I know what's possible. I've seen it. I've seen it in my heroes. I've seen it in the way they carry themselves. I've seen it through in what they've walked through with grace and dignity. I am not content to just have a hammer and a screwdriver. But in order to do that, I'm going to have to be willing to be uncomfortable sometimes. And I'm going to have to practice. I'm going to have to watch what you do and practice until I can do it too. So, the question on step 6 and 7 is, what is my security blanket? And am I willing to give it up 1 inch at a time? I was a preschool teacher when I got sober, and there was a little boy had a nasty little blanket. You know what little boy blankets look like. I mean, they carry them around, and I can't even imagine what kind of DNA is on those things. Just sort of stand it up in the corner, and his mother was just miserable about this blanket. That blanket owned her, and he was 4. And she's like, he's taking that damn blanket to college. I know he is. I cannot get it away from him. And she went home and she prayed on it. And she asked him if she could cut 1 inch off of that blanket every week. And he said, okay. And so they had this big ceremony every Monday. They had the blanket cutting ceremony. And there was music and donuts. It was a big deal. And they cut 1 inch off of that blanket, and he brought the blanket to school, and everything was fine. And the next week, yeah, and every Monday, we would applaud Brian's blanket, you know. And it got down to, you know, nasty bath towel size, and then it was nasty hand towel size. And at some point when it got down to about washcloth size, I looked around, and Brian didn't have his blanket. And I asked him what happened, and he said, oh, I don't really need it anymore. And eventually, he willingly threw it away. There are some defects of character that I have truly tried to surrender for good and for all. There are others that I have given up 1 inch at a time. And so, that's the question. Am I willing to give up just 1 inch at a time? I told you I was a thief. And I'd like to tell you that stopped when I got sober. It did not. And I'm not telling you I stole big, you know, I don't go in jewelry store heists. There's no Ocean's 11 here. It's Post-it notes from work, and it's nail polish from the Tom Thumb, and it's stupid stuff. And I will say that I surrendered it 1 inch at a time. And it got dramatically different, and it sort of became a barometer of my spiritual well-being. If I'm walking around Walmart with a package of pens in my hand saying, sober people don't steal, sober people don't steal, and I'm debating it, then I know there's something I really need to be doing some inventory work on. But I cannot say that I gave it up for good and for all, because I didn't. I didn't. As a matter of fact, I started sharing about it in meetings, which really annoyed some folks. I had some folks with double-digit sobriety coming up going, great, I can't use the self-checkout anymore. And, oh, y'all did that too? Anyway, so I started talking about it in meetings, and I have a little twitchy comes up to me, in the meeting, and she goes, oh, I steal stuff too. And I say, okay, cool. And she calls me again. Hey, I got some Burt's Bees and a Red Bull today. I'm like, okay, cool. She don't want to quit. She just wants somebody to know she's stealing, really. Believe it or not, little twitchy becomes my sponsee. Because I'm the only one she can talk to about this. And I don't tell her to stop. I just listen. I bear witness. And, well, then Twitchy starts traveling with me out of town sometimes because she's single and she can do that. And I go speak and she comes with me sometimes. And she really hates that I started sharing this story. Because sometimes she's in the room when I share it. But anyway, I did get her permission. She just hates it. So anyway, we went out of town. We were speaking in Waco, which is about an hour and a half from where we live. And we got in the car, and on the way back, I thought of this spot, this store that I really like in Waco. And I said, I want to stop at this. It's one of them shops that has stuff you don't really need. I love that stuff. Love it. And plenty T-shirts and just all that stuff. And so she's wandering around. I have to go to the bathroom. I go to the bathroom. In the bathroom, there's this giant bottle of Poo-Pourri. Have any of y'all heard the Poo-Pourri story? Good. This is terrible. So there's a giant bottle of Poo-Pourri. I love Poo-Pourri. I love Poo-Pourri. I think the person who invented Poo-Pourri should get the Nobel Peace Prize. That is the magical stuff. And there's this giant bottle sitting on the back of the potty in this bathroom at this shop. And there's a big sticker on this Poo-Pourri thing that says, do not steal the Poo-Pourri. Tester, if you steal the Poo-Pourri, you will have loose bowels or something. I remember it was gross. I remember whatever it said was gross and had to do with bodily functions. And I just read the part that said tester and dropped it in my big purse because I decided I could test it at home. It's not stealing. It's testing. This is going to go real wrong.
Jennifer.
It's going to go real wrong. So anyhow, I go find Twitchy. She's wandering around the store. We get ready to go. We're walking out to go to the car. And neither one of us noticed those metal things. And and it went beep, 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 and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and we hot-stepped it to the car. I mean, real quick-like. And we've been traveling for years. We are good friends, and we never run out of stuff to talk about. And yet, for 46 minutes, I clocked it. Not a word was spoken. I was doing some fumbling in my purse, which is when I discovered that underneath the sticker that said, don't steal this, there was a sensor. And so I say, hey, do you know why that thing beep, beep, beeped when we walked out? And she said, uh-huh. And I said, you do? And she said, uh-huh. And I pulled the giant Poo-Pourri out of my purse, and I said, well, it's because I took this. And she goes, shut up! And she pulls the car over, runs around to the back, gets out her purse, and in her purse, y'all, if I'm lying, I'm dying, I swear on a big book, brand new box of Poo-Pourri. I mean, tell me God isn't elegant. We stole the exact same thing.
These actions are not endorsed.
They are
by
absolutely not.
Alatoona Roundup in any way.
So just, much of
I need
my
a caveat story. Here. Can we get this on tape?
I promise. That is the last thing I ever stole. I made my amends. It is the last thing that I have knowingly or willfully stolen. I don't believe it's the last. I know it's not the last thing she stole. But for me, I was more than 20 years sober, and I was mortified. I was mortified, and I could see that this was blocking me from my usefulness to her. And that's the last thing that I ever took that did not belong to me, to my knowledge. I'm not saying that's never happened, but to my knowledge, I have never stolen anything again. That's what I surrendered, one inch at a time. Yeah. 8 and 9, I surrender my ego. I face the damage, and I go out and I make my attempt to repair the past. There may be some wrongs I cannot fully right, but I do the absolute best I can, and I do not fly solo on this. Ever, ever, ever. I run this past my sponsor every time. That's why there's an 8th step. I need to prepare, and then I go out. And I face my fellows, by the way. I didn't do... that's stupid because I'm going to tell you about an amends I made by email. But typically, I'm not allowed to send emails or texts or whatever on my amends. I don't do a lot of damage by mail. I do it face-to-face, up personal, and often in public. And that's the way that I've been asked to do amends. Now, there was one situation in the last 10 years where I owed an amends and I didn't want to give it up because I didn't want to surrender my version of the story. I did an inventory on this fella, and what I saw was that he was an untreated alcoholic and he was acting like untreated alcoholics act. And he behaved badly. Of course he did. But what I saw on my inventory was that I was somebody with double-digit sobriety who was my boss. And he was new and untreated, you know. And what wound up happening was things got really weird at the office. My husband came to work there. I started working there. My husband came to work there too. At one point, it's funny now, but it wasn't funny then. He took my husband to lunch, offered my husband my job, and sent my husband home to tell me about it. And poor Big Daddy did not think that through at all because I lost my dang mind. I was so angry and embarrassed, and I'd just gotten a new sponsor, and I called her up to tell her what had happened, and homegirl laughed so hard I thought she was going to wet her pants. I mean, she thought this was hilarious. She said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to burn the place down. I have a set of keys and a lighter. That's why I'm calling you. And so I quit that job. She allowed me and encouraged it pretty immediately, actually. And I quit the job. My husband stayed for a bit. But here's what would happen. I did the inventory on it. I saw the story. I knew that he was just a sick man who was behaving like a sick man. His job before he was running this now million-dollar roofing business was he ran his dad's car wash. He had no experience with leadership whatsoever. He was just running around making stuff up. And he's got this untreated alcoholism, so he has a big feeling and doesn't know what the heck to do with it, so he just wanders around looking for whose fault it is. You know, I mean, that's just what we do. And I know that story. And yet, every chance I get, I go, you want to hear about the worst boss I ever had? And I revert back to the story that I like better. So that when it's time for me to make those amends, why would I make amends to him? Except I'm back in bondage again. Guilt and shame has created a doorway one more time. And I mean, I pray on this. I talk to my sponsor about it. And I'm just dug in. I really like my version of the story. And finally, she said, what are you willing to do? One inch at a time. I said, I'll send him an email. She said, okay, we'll start there. But you have to offer to meet with him in the email. And if he wants to meet with you, you have to. I said, I'll do that. So I send him an email that says I was
arrogant and insubordinate. And arrogant and insubordinate. And and that I regret my behavior, that I didn't behave like a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wasn't the employee that he hired, and I'd like the opportunity to make it right. And within minutes, I got a response back. Minutes. And I don't know about you, but I'm like, oh, here we go. And he said, I never realized how much sunshine you brought to our office until you were gone. And I know you're probably not ready yet, but I really would like to be friends with you again someday. What am I supposed to do with that? I have to surrender my ego so that God can show me something different. The question for that is, am I telling myself a story I know isn't true? 10 and 11 is all about, you know, when I'm wrong. And I'm surrendering my additional terms and commitment and conditions may apply. You know, the fine print. I'm like, God, I want you to have my will in my life. Additional terms and conditions may apply. I have some small print. It's like, you know, you can have everything except. Or you can have everything provided. I'm not going to give up my booty call until you give me happily ever after. Bring him, and then he can go. I mean, it would just be foolish to let go of my side dude if there's not going to be anybody on the horizon. And I don't say that lightly. I went through, I don't know, it was more than a decade of single and celibate. I gave him time to work. Is all I'm saying. But what I came out of retirement for was not good on any level. And so so I'm giving up my secret terms and conditions. And so what 10 and 11 are, they're about taking a daily inventory, and they're about getting my assignment from God. And that daily inventory has changed my life, and it came about because I would dabble with it, and I didn't like what I found. I would dabble with it, and I didn't like what I found, and I would quit doing it because I didn't like what I found. I was congratulating myself on having made my amends. I was feeling good. I was feeling free. And then I do that 10th step and find out I'm still a liar, and I'm still a thief, and I'm still manipulative, and I'm still all those things. Those things are still popping up. Of course they are. I have a lifetime of habits that I've got to work through and surrender to God. Those behaviors are more established than right living. It's going to take practice. And in my arrogance, I think, well, I'm just going to stop looking for it. I convince myself that the 10-step inventory is making my defects flare up. The reality is I walk around being a jerk a lot, and I can go to sleep just fine if I don't look for it. But what happens is it makes the other people in my life responsible for taking my inventory, and that's not fair. Because I live with a man who has never once said, Jennifer, you're snapping my head off enough. He has never, not once, and trust me, he's had many opportunities. He will never do that. That's not who he is. So I walk around waiting for the day that his rubber band snaps and he's done for good and for all. Because I've made him responsible for telling me when he's not okay. And I tell you what, I think he'd pack a box before he'd do that. That's not fair. It's not somebody else's responsibility to tell me that what I'm doing is making them uncomfortable or hurting their feelings or inappropriate. Because I'm guilty of all of that. My sponsees are not often. I got one who will call me out. The rest of them won't. And I know I'm not flawless, but it's my responsibility to go, I teased her in that meeting in front of everybody. I got to go back. I got to go fix that. And that does two things. I give her the opportunity to hear that I know I was wrong, and it also lets her know it's okay to be wrong.
It's okay. None of us are getting out of here unscathed. We're all going to mess stuff up. That's evidence of life, but I got to be willing to show her that. And then I do that meditation so that I can get my assignment for the day. And that's become my favorite thing. Still and quiet was never my strong suit. Shocker. I know you're like, well, you could try it now. But anyway, I finally got to where I would attempt it. And a part of the reason why meditation was so difficult for me was my spiritual arrogance. I thought I knew what it was supposed to look like. I thought I knew what it was supposed to feel like. And I didn't have any experience. And so one of my very favorite meditations is that I get still and quiet and I try and focus in on that little light. Does everybody have a little light that's in the middle of their head? I don't know if this is me. Anyway, I got this little light spot that's in my head when I get really still and quiet and I focus my mind. There's a little light. When I get to the little light, I say, hey God, send me a color. And sometimes there's more than one color. Sometimes it changes colors. Sometimes colors swirl. Maybe this is just me. I don't know if this works for everybody. I'm just sharing it because it's my experience. So I ask God to send me a color. And I continue to focus until I get one color. And then I ask myself, what does that color mean to me? And there are some specific colors that usually have a specific meaning. There's a color that I have for hope, anger, fear, whatever. And sometimes that changes. Sometimes it's a combination and I kind of really need to think on. Wonder what that is. Then the fun starts. Because I go out into the world and I look for that color. And the question is, am I supposed to bring that thing to that person? Are they going to bring that thing to me? But it feels like I have a divine appointment. And there are a couple of you who have hope on right now. So we'll see. But it's one of my favorite things to do because I walk around looking for the person, a person or people wearing that color. And usually I'll just say something like, I love that top on you. That's a beautiful color. And I just start a conversation that way. And inevitably, or sometimes that's her favorite color. She wears that a lot. I'm going to call her. I'm just going to call her. That always feels crazy. Okay, I'm just going to tell you right now. When God puts somebody, I mean, the Jesus people call it putting them on your heart. That it feels crazy. And if you're like, I thought of Frank four times. I hadn't talked to Frank in 17 years. Why would I call Frank? God, spin the wheel. We need another guy. Why would I call Frank? And a lot of times, you know, that's going to pop up and we're going to go, I don't think you really meant Frank. That Frank, you know, it's either going to persist or it's going to go away. But what I will tell you, here's my experience. If I take the action, I inevitably find out that it was the right thing to do. I was just thinking about you. Or I have a question for you. Or whatever. Something happens that lets me know it really was a divine appointment. And the more I exercise that muscle, the less weird it feels. The 10th step in particular, as I said, I went to jail right before I turned 10 years sober for throwing away a ticket. I didn't have a job. I didn't tell my sponsor because my sponsor was like, you don't have a job. You can go sit it out. I knew that was what she was going to say, and I was becoming kind of a big deal in AA. And I had God's work to do. I couldn't be sitting in a jail cell, you know, where there were people you could be talking to about AA. Okay, I didn't think about that part. But what wound up happening was I got that ticket, I threw it away, and I started getting asked to talk different places, and they'd pay for my gas to hear me talk. So I was fixing to drive to Oklahoma. What I would do back then when I had somewhere to go where I could go in a car, I would take my least grateful sponsee. I would put her in the car. I wish I was making this up. Y'all ever heard of pride goeth before the fall? So I put my least grateful sponsee in the car because I wanted to show her what a big deal I was. You know, maybe she'd listen to me better if she found out. That's paid for my gas. Watch this. And I'm an idiot. Anyway, So right before she showed up, I was going to drive because I had my first brand new car I bought by myself. And I looked down, and the sticker on my car is a year out of date, and which is what I got that other sticker for, too. Huh, who knows? I take stickers as suggestions. Back then, there were two stickers. Now there's just one sticker, and I peeled that one that was expired off, and I threw it away. That was my solution. I didn't forge a new one or nothing. I mean, it was just dumb. So I throw away that sticker. I put her in the car. We get exactly one county away. I know where there's this really cool coffee shop, and I'm playing the big shot, so I'm going to show her my really cool coffee shop. And I see the cop, and the cop sees me, and I say, "Hey, guess what's going to happen?" And she said, "What?" And I said, "I'm fixing to go to jail." And she said, "No, you're not." I said, "Watch this." And the cop walks up, and a second cop car is right behind him. And I'm like, "Check it out." And he says, "Ma'am, do you know why I pulled you over?" I said, "I got a feeling." And here's my favorite part of this dumb story. She leans across and goes, "Officer, this is my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous." Anonymous is in the name! And she explains that this sticker situation is a big misunderstanding, and that she personally will make sure that if he lets us go to Oklahoma, where I am speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, that she will make sure that I address this sticker ticket situation. So I went to jail. And it is a way too long a story to tell, but I'm so arrogant, I've got the money to get out in my purse. That's never happened before. And we had left really early because I wanted to show her a lot of, you know, fun spots on the way. And so I'm like, "This is no big deal. This is no big deal. I'm going to get myself out. We're going to go to Oklahoma City. I'm going to talk. It'll be great." Y'all, this has been 20 years ago. Every time I cross the Red River, somebody goes, "Wait a minute, aren't you that one that went to jail?" Every time. I was there 2 weeks ago at a YPAW conference, and somebody came, "Hey, were you the one that didn't go to the Western Club because she was in jail?" That's me. And so I go to jail, and I forget that when you're in jail, they don't let you out on your schedule. And so at, you know, 8:47, I get out of jail that night, and I got to find the sponsee. This is before I had a cell phone. I got to call her from the payphone repeatedly because she took my car. They were cool about that. They didn't impound my car. And I stayed with her, and because she had a lot of feelings to share. Apparently, I had time to think about my amends, and I made them. And I had heard this speaker recently talk about how when he makes amends, he says, "You know, if you'd like to tell me how you felt about that, I'm prepared to listen." And I thought that sounded real cool and real spiritual, and I said it. And then I found out I lied. I was not prepared to listen. She had a lot to share. A lot. And I wasn't her sponsor after that, as a matter of fact. Isn't that crazy? Apparently, you go to jail one time with a sponsee in the car, and it negates everything you've ever said. Just threw out all those spiritual gifts. And when I didn't show up in Oklahoma, my friend from Oklahoma called everybody he knew in Dallas. Now, he knew a bunch of folks. He called them all looking for me. And I got home, and there were 37 messages on my answer machine, and I am not that popular. And they had called people from different groups. They had called most of the guys from my home group. I was the only woman at my home group at that time. And so all the guys from my home group got a call. They called my sponsor. My sponsor called. And I'm like, I wasn't going to tell anybody. I was going to tell my sponsor, I knew it, and the sponsee knew, and I thought that was sufficient, and now I got 37 messages. And I call my sponsor, and that sponsor was not a laughing, giggling sponsor, and she laughed so hard she almost wet her pants. And I said, what do I do about all these messages? Do I tell them I had car trouble? Because technically I did. And she said, oh, no, ma'am. You're going to tell this whole story. Make sure they got time. Ask them if you're interrupting and call back if you are. Tell them all of it. Tell them about the throwing away the ticket. Tell them about peeling off the sticker. Tell them about the coffee shop. Tell them about her. This is my sponsor. Tell them the whole freaking thing. And I was the only woman in a group full of men. Let me tell you something. Those men razzed me to death. I mean, I would pull up in the parking lot, I would open the door, and they would go, Huddleston, what kind of birds don't fly? And they laughed. And the thing about it was, for those of you who don't know, a jailbird don't fly. And the thing about it was, it never stopped being funny to them. Like, the more they told it, the funnier it got. Hey, Mike. Do you know what kind of bird over? No, I don't know what kind of bird. Let's ask Jennifer. What kind of bird over? Anyway, so I pick up my 10-year cake. Guess what's on my 10-year cake?
There's not a jailbird on your desk.
There is a freaking jailbird with the stripes on his little uniform and a ball around his little birdie foot. And they laughed and they laughed and they laughed. And here's the thing. People teach you because they love you. They teach you because they love you. And I'm going to give a hint to anybody who may be new around here. If you are getting teased, do not give up your seat. You sit on that seat and you hang on tight. And I'm going to make you a promise. If you sit tight, hang on. Let them laugh about it every time. If you wait long enough and pray hard enough, someone will do something dumber than you. If I'm lying, I'm dying. Let me testify. Took about 3 weeks. The dude from my home group got drunk and passed out on his sponsor's doorstep. In his drawers. I've never been happier to hear a story. But I'm sitting in that group, and it's probably 2 weeks after this has all happened. I've gotten my dumb jailbird cake. And I'm sitting in that group, and I'm listening to my friends share. And I suddenly realize I almost got myself drunk. Not because my dad died, not because my mom died, not because I lost my job, not because I miscarried a baby, but because I was gonna try and keep a secret to preserve my image of myself. Because, by the way, those 37 people that I called, none of them went, I cannot believe you did that. Every single one of them laughed and said, yeah, that sounds about right. The only person who believed I was better than that was me. And all of a sudden, what I realized was that the 10th step is far more important than the 10 years. That taking that daily inventory and being willing to come clean on my secrets is far more important than what Roman numeral is on my chip. And so I started telling the truth whether I like it or not. I started ratting myself out on the regular because I am far more afraid of what happens when I don't tell the truth than I am of what you will think if I do. We're in the saving our butt business, not our saving our face business. And 10 and 11 are crucial to that. Because anything that blocks me from you blocks me from God. And I cannot fight alcoholism alone. We have a 100% rate of losing people who manage this on their own.
I can't, we can't. So the question for steps 10 and 11 are to ask God, what do you want from me? And what do you want for me? In the 12th step, we surrender our time. I carry the message, and there's more freaking practice. I carry the message, and there's more freaking practice. I go to them. They're not responsible for coming to me. It's that same thing with the 10th step where I think other people are supposed to be responsible for my inventory. I'm supposed to be bringing it to them, not vice versa. And a part of my story was there was a time when AA stopped feeling safe to me, and I was sponsoring myself. I got sideways with my sponsor. I felt like she had betrayed a trust. Today, I believe she just made an error in judgment, and I never talked to her about it. She had been my sponsor for a long time, and I just kind of stuffed it down, and what happened was I gradually kind of pulled away from her, and I wasn't talking to her as much, and it was so gradual that I really didn't notice what was happening until it had happened for a long time. So I'm sponsoring myself, and my life is getting good. I just met Big Daddy. I'm falling in love. I'm singing Disney songs. Everything's fine. Why would I bother her with this? Because this is going to get messy, and I don't want to do that. And what happened was I sponsor girls with problems other than alcoholism. I know, it's shocking. The little wackadoodles really like me, and that's cool, except... sometimes their problems other than alcoholism flare up, and I don't recognize it as a problem other than alcoholism. And what happened was I'm sponsoring some girls that have some other diagnoses. We take our medication. We have outside help. I believe in all of that stuff. And if you don't, that's fine. That's the way you sponsor. But I'm just saying I think there is a time and a place for that. And I know people who will not stay sober. They will not stay alive if they don't seek outside help and sometimes get some things that will allow them to work these steps honestly. That's my experience. It's my experience. So anyway, so I'm sponsoring these gals who have problems other than alcoholism, and what I discovered is that when they stop taking their medications or their medications stop working, and either has happened, sometimes there's some anger. And a lot of times that anger was directed at me. But the problem was I was not being actively sponsored. And so the person who is standing outside of my life looking at it objectively is no longer doing that because I am not letting her in. And what happened was I felt like the only thing that I was good at was AA, and now I'm no longer good at AA. Because the women I sponsor, a couple of them are really, they are angry and they are blaming me, and I am scared. Like, I'm scared. And what that starts looking like is just a couple of fewer meetings. Come a little bit later. Leave a little bit earlier. Run as soon as the Lord's Prayer is over so that nobody asks you to sponsor them. Because I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. But I'm one of my favorite speakers, and I'll go almost anywhere to hear my talk. And so I get asked to speak. Back then I was often the Friday night speaker, and I give my funny little Friday night talk, and that's great. Problem is those things don't end on Friday night. So I'm sitting on that front row with a big dumb speaker ribbon, and you can't pull these things off, by the way, just like stickers. But anyhow, in a small room like this, that's hard to do. But in the big one, it works just fine. Put on some glasses, put your hair up, you're fine. I'm anonymous again. But anyway, so I'm sitting on that front row with the speaker thing, and at some point during the weekend, at the end of the talk, you know, somebody's going to start wandering somewhere I don't want them to go. And you've heard these speakers, and I have too. And so, you know, there's somebody else. I'm sitting on that front row, and I'm ready for him to wrap it up. That was a great talk. We've had a good hour and 72 minutes. But I'm needing Scooter to wrap it up. And what Scooter does instead is he goes, "And just to include, I'm going to say one more thing, and then I'm going to wrap her up at... Two times a year, me and the fellas I sponsor, we go out to the lake and we study the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And we start the preface, the foreword, the doctor's opinion, and we read all the way through AA number 3. And let me tell you what happens to these fellas." And he starts talking about this whole thing, and my ears start getting real red, and the back of my neck starts getting good and sweaty. And I'm thinking, wrap it up, Scooter. The ice cream social's about to start, you know?
But instead he goes on and on and on about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm getting real uncomfortable because I'm sitting on that front row knowing I'm a fraud. And I go to my room and I pray about it and I think about it and I go, okay, I used to do this and I'm not doing it anymore and I need to get back started. And I go home and I think about it till the next funny Friday night talk. And I'm sitting on the front row with a big dumb ribbon that says, speak here. And the Saturday night speaker says, every Tuesday night in the Lady That Sponsor, we study the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are racketed into the barter and general. And I'm like, Trixie, dude, seriously, he's run out of CD. And,
wow.
And I go home and I think about it. And I think about it for almost 2 years. And what happens was I'm sponsoring these little gals. I'm sponsoring Ish. It's kind of hard to hold anybody's feet to the fire when you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. They're going to meetings and they're getting sponsees. And they're calling me, hey, got any sponsee spots? I got a new sponsee. Her name is Rainbow. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. And Rainbow's on step one. What do we do with step one? What do we do with step one? I don't know what we do with step one. And I go, well, you read the doctor's opinion and you explain the phenomenon of craving. What page is it on? And I'm like, do what I did with you. What page is it on? And so I say, stay there, and I type some stuff up and I send it off to her, and she and Rainbow sit down and they read the doctor's opinion. Hey, Spines! Rainbow's on step two. What do we do? Okay, you're going to read this and this and this. We agnostics and choose your own conception of God. What page is it? Oh, for the love of God, come on. Stay there, type it up, send it on. Hey, Spine! Rainbow's on step three. It's a prayer. For the love of God, it's a prayer. I don't know what page it's on. It's on this side of the page. Really about the benevolence. Right here. It's right here. And in anger and in arrogance, I say, you know what? Let me tell you something. I've been thinking about this. I've been thinking we ought to do a step study. And she says, hey, let's do that. Can I bring Rainbow? And I'm like, yo, shoot, wait. Let me work out the logistics. I'll get back to you. I'm not a logistics girl. I didn't even show up on time. I mean, I am not a... And at that time, I was driving a 10-year-old Hyundai that I had painted with chalkboard paint. Only one of the door handles worked, and I had no spare tire. I mean, I'm not a logistics girl. When I say I trust God, I just fling myself out into the universe, and we see what happens. And but I tell her I'm going to work out the logistics, and because I sponsor the kind of girls I sponsor, she called three other women and said, Jennifer's going to do a step study. You call her and ask her about it. And they did. And in anger and arrogance, with not one pure motive, I say, okay, we'll do this. We're meeting at Monday nights at 7:30 at the Starbucks at the corner of Spring Creek and Coit. I'm not inviting these people to my house. I am not going to dust. Because I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. They're going to show up for one meeting or maybe two. And then they're going to start flaking. And their kid's going to have softball, and they got PMS, and I got a migraine, and I am again. And it's going to be right around that four step. Shocker. I know. Spoiler alert. But they're going to start flaking. And 1 week I'm going to show up, and I'm going to be by myself. And on that week I'm going to be done. And I'm too arrogant to think I'm going to drink, although I probably would have. I think I'll just go back to the First Methodist Church. I'll, you know, put on these flowery dresses that I bought for AA. I'll start making some casseroles and go to the year-long Bible study, and I'll be fine. So I show up that first Monday night, and I don't remember how many women were there. I think it was close to a dozen, because that seems about right. And I did it
12 and 12 study, because again, I'm not going to invest in this. It's not going to last very long. I had written up some little questions, and man, they were low and over the plate. They were about one step above an AA word search. Just altruistic. You know, I mean, I am not bringing the heat by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just checking off boxes. And I look down, and they've all got brand new 12 and 12s, and they got brand new little highlighters, and they are so excited. They are so excited. And I start to talk about the first step, and one of the girls stops me and says, "Hey, aren't we going to pray?" Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. And so I stop and we pray, and we start this step study, and they took it seriously, and my life began to change. That's what happened. They took it seriously, and my life began to change. And by the time we took the third step prayer together, I had a new sponsor and a clean copy of the big book, and I was ready to roll, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I hadn't in years. In years. We got done with the 12 and 12, and they wanted to keep going, and I said, "I'll do that, but we're going to go through the big book, and when we come to a step, we're going to take it, and if you're not willing to do that, I'm not willing to do this." And they said, "Let's go." And we went through that. The next year, we did the big book, the 12 and 12, and the traditions. First step, first in the 12 and 12, first tradition. It took us almost a full year. And this poor little Asian man who was just fascinated with whatever we were doing at Starbucks, I think he went through almost all of it with us. He would just sort of pace back and forth and sit back. He couldn't figure out what the hell we were, you know? Like, they're not the Jesus people for sure. But they pray. We don't know what the, you know, and but they took it seriously. And I was rocketed. And we kept going. And I started sponsoring some gals from out of town because they heard my talk and they wanted to try what we do. And so we continued this study, and I said, "How would y'all feel if we set up like an iPad or a laptop and tried, I had Google Meet, and tried to let some of these girls who were out of town be in on our meeting?" And the gals thought that was a great idea. And that was 4 months before the pandemic. You tell me God's not paying attention. And we've kept right on going, and we still have a Monday night meeting, and we had kind of big booked a 12 and 12'd it up. We're about to start back, but during the pandemic, I just randomly, there was a book on my shelf that I had only read one article in. It's a little book called Emotional Sobriety, and I said, let's try this out during a pandemic. While we're all home with our spouses and mothers and children, with a gun to my head, I could not have picked a better piece of literature to study during that time. You tell me God's not paying attention. We met on Monday night, and we will meet this coming Monday night. We do skip holidays because we're not a real AA meeting. But these ladies have changed my life. And they helped me walk my mama home. And they are the reason why I will never try to do anything alone again. Because God was not subtle with that. I'm sponsoring probably, I think I got 10. I don't count. You know, I believe in the AA answer. How many people are you sponsoring? Oh, about half of them. But the reality is, everybody I sponsor is doing stuff. It's weird. It's weird. But out of the 10 or so that I'm working with, at least 5 are walking parents or grandparents home. So my experience of the last 6 months is being turned to good account even as we speak. Tell me God's not paying attention. Tell me that dark past is not being recycled. Tell me that season of being more scared than I have ever been in my entire life is not bearing witness to those that I would help of God's power, God's love, and God's way of life. So the question for step 12 is, are there any strings attached to the gifts I share in Alcoholics Anonymous? Is there anything I've said, "I'll do this, but not that? Is there any area of my life where I've put a limit on God's love, God's power, and God's way of life that I am not sharing openly and honestly with the people God places in front of me? I am so sorry that I was late, but I am so glad that you were here and that you stayed. God has allowed me an amazing life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my very favorite promise is the best is yet to come. I'm glad to be here, and it's a good day to be here.